Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally, for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This is it. The time has come.
Saturday night's all right for fighting.
Push him down.
Get in the ring and go the distance with Fight Night with Adam Catterall and Gareth A. Davies.
You're better than that
on Talk Sport.
Welcome to the Fight Night podcast. I'm Adam Catterall. It's a pleasure once again to be in your company. However, if this is the first time you've ever come across us, please hit subscribe on iTunes. You're looking for Fight Night. You'll never miss out on any of our content. We'll always turn up on a Monday morning with you with the very best guests. And if you need an Android feed, you can get it on the TalkSport website. We've got Spotify and various things on there as well. TalkSport.com is what you are looking for. Now, coming up on this particular edition of the Fight Night podcast, you're going to hear from Savannah Marshall. You're going to hear from Josh Taylor. Eddie Earn will pop up as well. And we'll also hear from Lawrence Accorley. But we've also got loads of other little bits to get stuck into as well. We had a fantastic author, Brian Dugan, join us on the show at the weekend to talk about his new book, The Super Fight, Hagler versus Leonard. Not just about the fight, but about the build-up to it and the character traits of both of these guys. He's going to be on this podcast a little bit later on, but we're going to start by getting stuck into the modern-day heavyweights. Yes, that's right. Last weekend, Usyk and Chisora went at it, didn't they? We're going to give you a full breakdown and review. Our thoughts are coming up very, very shortly. We're also going to talk about Tyson Fury's upcoming fight on December the 5th and maybe an opponent that he should have gone for over Ajit Kabayel. But we'll start by talking about White Povetkin. For those that don't know, it's off. Take a listen. A lot of people will have already heard the news this week on TalkSport that Alexander Povetkin has sadly found himself with COVID-19. He's in hospital being treated for that at the moment. So therefore, the rematch on November the 21st is off. Rescheduled for January, the back end of January there, which gives both men a couple of extra months to get themselves fit and ready to rock and roll for that rematch showdown. And I don't know how you feel about this, Gareth, but my initial thoughts when I heard the news was a bit of relief because I thought November the 21st was a touch too early for Dillian White. He will tell me otherwise. I've no doubt about that. But for me, when you get knocked out in the state that he did get knocked out in Eddie's back garden on those fantastic nights in fight camp, I just thought the turnaround was a little bit too quick. I'm glad that he's going to get the extra 8 weeks just to have a little bit of extra time, maybe even some time off, and then he can get himself back in the gym and get himself all fired up and ready to go at the start of 2021.
Oh, no, I agree with that. But we did have him on the show last week, and you weren't around. And Dillian was very lucid from Portugal and seemed really ready for it. Obviously, it was a couple of days before the revelation that Sasha Povetkin had tested positive for COVID-19, Adam. But I completely agree with you. That amount of time going into the new year will just buy him time for the body to have a rest again and then to head back over to Portugal. Look, I think it's a fight he can win. And I think it's a fight he can win well. It's a fight he was winning really well. And I don't think he's going to be hit again by a punch like that. It was brought to light. It was underlined. He was caught by Oscar Rivas on the ropes in a similar way. He was caught by Anthony Joshua in a similar way. You know, I don't think Dillian's going to make that same mistake. And he was alluding to that when Conor Benn and myself spoke to him last week live on the show, kind of in the throes of... I think he was predicting, actually, that Derek would do well against Alexander Usyk. It was just before the fight last week. But the key is with Dillian, he's not dented. You know, he's damaged, he's dented, but not truly traumatized by it. And I think that's a great attitude. I think he bounces back. The problem he's got, Adam, is, and you'll appreciate this, it's where where he goes next year with what we expect to happen if Anthony Joshua and Tyson Fury both win on December the 5th and December the 12th. You know?
Yeah, well, exactly. And because of that, I wasn't too surprised to see his promoter, Eddie Hearn, obviously throw his tweet out this week about Fury, White and all that type of thing, saying that they would be up for taking a fight with Tyson Fury on December the 5th. Because I genuinely believe that no matter what happens with Dillian White and Alexander Povetkin, he's at least 18 months away from getting himself a shot at a world title, because, fingers crossed, we're going to get Fury AJ 2. That's going to take at least 12 months to play out, and therefore the runners and riders of this division aren't really going to get their shot unless politics comes in and the WBO stick their oar in, and we have Alexander Usyk, obviously, fighting for that title at some point. You never know, there might be an avenue there, but I just think that Dillian White's about 18 months away. So I wasn't surprised to see Eddie Hearn chirp up saying, listen, we'll take the Fury fight, even though he knew full well, we knew full well, that there was no chance whatsoever that that fight would be made on that particular short period of notice. So I'm quite happy that they haven't rushed anything. I know that Derek Chisora chirped up this week as well, and I kind of like that from Derek, you know. I know that he went 12 rounds with Alexander Usyk, but I kind of like his attitude. Not the fact that I wasn't overly excited about the fight itself. I love the attitude. That's what I want from my fighters. I want them to be game. I want them to say, any guy, any place, anywhere, I want them to show willing. I love what Derek did last week where he said, listen, I'll step in. I'll fight Dillian White on 2 weeks' notice. No problem whatsoever. I have no need, really, to see White Chisora 3. But on 2 weeks' notice, I was going to be okay with it. However, with a little bit of hindsight and with the dust settling on it, I'm kind of happy that it's not happening just for Dillian White's sake, just to have that extra 8 weeks to get himself back on track and get himself fully refreshed.
Absolutely right. And look, you're spot on. Eddie Hearn had to throw his tweets out of the pram, if that's the wrong expression, really. But he had to throw his tweets out of there. You know, I saw Eddie and Barry Hearn in the week. And as I said, and, you know, I talked to him about it. And he was saying, look, we need to do these things in this time and just make these suggestions, because you never know what people are going to say. You never know if Tyson Fury might have said, yeah, I'll bash Dillian White up. It's fine. I'll do it. I'll just do it. It depends what mood Tyson Fury is in. And, you know, I think I would like to see that fight. I do hope we get to see it. But I do think if Tyson Fury does defeat Anthony Joshua once or maybe twice, I'm not so sure we're going to see him fight anyone else again. I don't think he's got an awful lot more to prove in the heavyweight division.
And if he has
two fights with Anthony Joshua, and I've said all along, my view is that there will be a fight in Saudi Arabia in April, May next year, because, you know, you're looking at a $60 million to $100 million site fee. You know, and a big pay-per-view like we've never seen before in the UK, and you know, and all the revenue that will come in, the fighters are going to earn, I think, minimum $60 million each for that fight. Minimum $60 million. It could even go as high as $100 million each. It is a massive fight. And, you know, if those guys have two and they have the second one at Wembley Stadium late in the summer, and when, you know, the country's hopefully kind of able to amass again in large crowds, Adam, you know, these two guys, both of them are going to wonder about where they really need to fight again, because they're going to have so much money and the legacy of the era will have been completed. Unless Tyson Fury wants to hang around for the likes of Daniel Dubois if he emerges as the next strong contender, you know, or the next strong champion, then I do think it might be the end of the road for Tyson Fury next year. I can see him walking away.
Yeah, I'm totally on board with that. I don't think there's anything after the Joshua, like you just said, the climax of this particular era. I think after that, I don't think there's anything left for him to complete. He's absolutely clocked the game, hasn't he? Talking about last week's performance, where Alexander Usyk came through, won over a 12-round period, got the decision against Derek Chisora. I don't know about you, Gareth. I know you were on the radio last week. It's very difficult to score fights when you're on the radio and watching a fight whilst trying to conduct a radio program. Yeah. But I'm sure you've gone back and watched it. I mean, I personally scored it 116-112 in favour of Usyk. I thought he comfortably won eight of the rounds. I understand that Derek was most certainly aggressive. It was very Bull Matador type of fight for me. And I did come away from it slightly disappointed, I'm going to be honest, because I expected at a certain point in this fight Alexander Usyk to dig his toes into the canvas and have a real good go at Derek Chisora. And that's, you know, that's no disrespect to Derek. I know what I'm getting with him. I know he's going to be game. I know he was in unbelievable shape and he did keep coming forward. But I just thought that between maybe 6 and 10 Oleksandr, especially when he stung him in the seventh round, I thought, right, here we go, put your foot down and let's see what you're all about at heavyweight. And he never really went to those levels. And I wouldn't be surprised if we listen to Tyson in a moment and he's not really overly enamoured with it, because I can't see now Oleksandr Usyk. I mean, I know he's got ambitions to become the undisputed heavyweight champion of the world. That's only happening if Anthony Joshua and Tyson Fury retire before he gets that opportunity, because I can't see him beating either of those guys at this moment.
Yeah, I agree with you, and I think there's reasons for that. You know, I think you're going to get a special one from Tyson Fury in a minute, believe me. Here's the thing, I felt that what we needed to see in this fight from Oleksandr Usyk was some power, some power at heavyweight. Obviously, the ability to hang with these big guys. You know, Derek Chisora was, for anyone listening, Derek Chisora was 3 stone heavier than Oleksandr Usyk. You know, 40 pounds heavier than him. Oleksandr Usyk, for those who've been under a rock for the last 3 years, is the undisputed cruiserweight champion of the world and has stepped up to the heavyweight division, has been given a mantle by the World Boxing Organization as their mandatory challenger without really proving anything at heavyweight. So, you know, and he was a brilliant, brilliant cruiserweight. David Haye's done it before him, and the great Evander Holyfield. David Haye was great as well. I must include him in that. They were both brilliant cruiserweights who stepped up to win world titles at heavyweight. The problem, as you rightly say, the two champions incumbent right now are too big for him. We did not see, especially in that seventh round when Derek was hurt, we did not see the explosive power from, or one-punch knockout power even, that Oleksandr Usyk probably needs against the very biggest men in the division. Plus, the Dillian Whites some of the others, even Joseph Parker. He's going to outbox people. He's a brilliant mover. He's fantastically agile. I agree with you. It was 7-5 or 8-4 in rounds, in my view. He won it clearly. There was no dispute about it. That was David Haye we heard just now speaking to us last week on the show just after the fight. Simon Jordan, though, I've got to pick a bone of Simon, and he's a friend of mine, you know, and a friend of the show and a friend of the station. But I thought he was completely out of order last week, hammering Derek Chisora. And Simon's a very knowledgeable boxing guy, and that's what surprised me. Derek Chisora went 12 rounds with Vitaly Klitschko in Munich I think it was January or February 2012. He is a brilliant heavyweight. Simon was claiming that Derek Chisora had been roundly beaten twice by Dillian White. I had Derek beating Dillian in that first fight by a round, and a lot of people did. He's not short of elite level. He's very, very close to it. And you can pick a football side, can't you, that, you know, can get to finals and not win. It doesn't mean they're not elite. Derek Chisora is an elite heavyweight. There's no doubt about it in my mind. And I thought, especially in a sport where, you know, and a few days after he'd fought Usyk, where Usyk outboxed him, he didn't beat the hell out of him. I thought he was very, very unfair to Derek. And, you know, Simon's a guy with a lot of opinions, and most of them are amazing, but I thought he was wrong to hammer Derek Chisora on air the other day. Really, really wrong. Because when a fighter's lost like that, when he's put everything into it, and David Haye was there like the ringmaster in the build-up to that fight, Derek Chisora put everything on the line for that fight, put everything into building. And you know what? He's hurting. Don't knock a guy when he's down like that. There's no need for it.
Mm. Should we get Tyson Fury's opinion?
Should we get Oleksandr Simon Jordan Usyk in right now?
Let's get Tyson Fury's opinion on Oleksandr Usyk, because, as I said, I came away from it slightly disappointed. I expected a little bit more from Oleksandr Usyk. I think he's just going to fall short when it comes to the Furies and the Anthony Joshuas. I might be completely wrong, but let's get the WBC heavyweight champion of the world's thought process. This is a conversation that he had with Gareth a little earlier on this week.
Did we see the best Oleksandr Usyk? I'm not sure. Did we see the best Oleksandr Usyk at heavyweight? I don't know. But on that performance, I can say that none of the top 15 heavyweights out there are sweating Oleksandr Usyk at the moment, unfortunately. None of us are quaking. None of us are like, is that it? Everyone's like, okay. Is that what all the hype was about? It is what it is. This is a heavyweight game. And heavyweights ain't like they were years ago. And Chisora is probably the smallest heavyweight out there. Mm. Being brutally honest, I think when he fights a big heavyweight, who can punch a bit, I think it'd be like a lamb to slaughter.
My takeaway, for what it's worth to you, is that I thought you could feel Usyk going through the first four rounds. You could feel him thinking, wow, I really am in here with a much heavier man. Those three rounds, you could see it on his face. You could see it in his body posture. But I know he's a slow starter and he likes to think his way into a fight. It's that Eastern European style that he and Lomachenko both do. He had Derek hurt in the seventh, I thought, you know, and, you know, probably should have tried to get him out of there. But I think a lot had been taken out of his body by then. He's a great mover. I think he could survive against big heavyweights.
Maybe.
I don't think he's got the single explosive power that he needs to put the big heavyweights on the back foot. That's my view, you know?
Yeah, listen, it's a valid point. My opinion of it is, you know, it's the heavyweight division and not the cruiserweight division for a reason. But I understand, look, all cruiserweights who do well want to step up to heavyweight to get that big money. They all want a piece of the pie. But there's divisions for reasons. And me personally, I think if he steps up, after his last performance, I obviously thought he was better than he was. Because I highly rated Alexander Usyk as a master technician, as the cruiserweight. Mm. But that heavyweight, there was nothing that impressed me, to be fair.
No. Tyson Fury there, catching up with Gareth. The full conversation, by the way, is on Gareth's YouTube channel. Make sure you go and check it out. I just wanted to highlight that particular piece on Alexander Usyk. And I agree with everything that Tyson's saying there. Bar the top 15 thing, I think Alexander Usyk hangs with the majority of that top 15. I think there might be 3-4 guys that would ask him a lot more questions than the others. Obviously, Tyson Fury being one of them. He's just 6'9", and I think he would comfortably deal with the likes of Alexander Usyk. But again, what I would like to reiterate on this, and I think Tyson was alluding to it there a touch, after watching him in the cruiserweight division, Usyk on the road against all these killers, he went in everybody's back garden and he smashed them all to bits, outboxed some of them, smashed them all, did whatever he needed to do and become the undisputed cruiserweight champion of the world. His footwork, his technique, everything about him was absolutely mustard. And I had it in my head that he would be... Tyson Fury would always be too much for him, but I honestly believed that he could compete with Anthony Joshua and maybe even beat Anthony Joshua. But watching him at the weekend against Derek Chisora, that thought process has gone away from my mind a little bit now, because I just think Anthony Joshua hits too hard, he's too big, and once he does sniff a little bit of blood, Anthony Joshua, he is great at taking people out. There's no question about that. And Usyk just needs to commit. You're right in what you were saying there. There was an opportunity in the seventh round, I think, against Derek Chisora to commit and go for it. And he didn't do that. And I don't know whether it's because he was worried about what was coming back, but because he didn't do it, it's given me more questions than I had answers from the weekend.
Yeah, definitely. Like you say, you've said it two or three times now, disappointed. And I'm not so much disappointed as I think we found something out. And look, I think I've made the point, Tyson Fury made the point when I spoke to him in this long interview that it is about styles. I mean, Eddie Hearn concurred on that as well, because he's so capable, Usyk, of transforming his style. We've seen him stand toe-to-toe with people, yeah, and bash people up at some cruiserweight. We saw it against Tony Bellew. Tony Bellew was winning on points, for me anyway, in that fight before he was knocked out midway through the sixth or seventh round in that fight in Liverpool, that brilliant night when he finished in the cruiserweight division. But I'm looking at the list here, Ed, of the biggest and best heavyweights. Deontay Wilder and Alexander Usyk is a very, very interesting fight. I know we're going to talk about Deontay later on. Luis Ortiz and Alexander Usyk is an interesting fight. I think he wins that. I'm talking about Usyk now.
I think
Usyk can beat Andy Ruiz. I think he might have similar problems against Dillian White that he had against Derek Chisora. Might be pushed further to the
Agreed.
Wire. Joseph Parker is a shootout. Not a shootout. Is a 50-50 boxing
Joseph,
match.
That is a great fight.
It is very interesting. I think it's a chess match in lots of ways. You know, both very patient fighters. Daniel,
very fast guys.
Hey, what about this one, right? And we haven't talked about the two big men yet. Daniel Dubois or Joe Joyce against Alexander Usyk.
It's a great fight. I mean, he's had obviously a history with Joe Joyce, hasn't he, in the amateurs. Daniel Dubois is supposed to be the next big thing. I mean, that is an unbelievable fight, I think.
Can you imagine? But can you imagine Alexander Usyk going 12 rounds with Daniel Dubois, even now? I know he's very, very inexperienced, and people will poo-poo me right now saying that Daniel Dynamite Dubois has not done enough. But, you know, it's the size of these people as well.
Yeah.
And they only need to have, you know, a semblance of the same boxing ability as Usyk. And I just think there's trouble there. I think he'll have a short, excuse me, a short, but top of the division shot at heavyweight. I don't think there's a long career. Look at David Hay.
I think he needs the boxing politics just to work in his favour a little bit here.
Exactly.
He's not going to become undisputed champion, but if the WBO maybe force the issue, and we as people who work in this sport, and most certainly as fans, we want Fury AJ. We don't want anything to get in the way of that. I'm prepared to sacrifice undisputed heavyweight champion in the world. If the WBO belt is not on the line, I'm happy with it. Just make the fight. I need to see Fury AJ. And that might be the way then for Usyk to become heavyweight champion.
Yeah, exactly. That's a very good point, Ed. And you know, we may even see that, because the point when if Fury and Joshua both win on December the 5th and December the 12th, where, and you know, at the Royal Albert Hall and Wembley Arena, we don't even need any belts on the line, frankly.
No,
because it is for the undisputed title.
We all know. We know who's number one. Exactly. We know who's number two.
Exactly. We just need those two guys to go and fight. And as we said at the top of the show, they may not fight much again afterwards. They may not need to, you know. So, there's a point. Fighters make the belts, and there's a point when the belts become irrelevant. Floyd Mayweather didn't need belts in the end. It was Floyd Mayweather. And I think we're getting to that stage with these two guys in the division, you know. And like you say, if Usyk hangs around long enough and he's clever enough and careful enough and they match him cleverly, because if he takes a proper beating at heavyweight, not just knocked out, if he takes a proper beating, I think he'll be finished in the division.
We have to obviously then make reference to the trilogy with Deontay Wilder falling off. And the video that Deontay Wilder put out this time last week, well, last Sunday it was, wasn't it, when it hit the internet. Now, we've seen the rumours and we've seen the fans talking about crazy excuses that have been made in the aftermath of the defeat back in February to Tyson Fury. We've heard people talk about the glove situation. We've heard people talk about the suit situation. We've talked about all different aspects of excuses, but I don't think we've seen it coming out of Deontay Wilder's mouth. We did last weekend. And my overriding thought, Gareth, and I don't know where you're at with this, is that Deontay Wilder needs some good people around him. He's got obviously a lot of yes people that are filling his head with absolute nonsense. He's in total denial of the situation of what actually happened on that particular night. To be throwing the likes of Mark Brennan under the bus, I think is absolutely ludicrous. To be obviously throwing the referee under the bus, again, absolutely ludicrous. He has got himself into a right state with this, and I personally think that he needs some proper help. He needs a bit of a rest, and he needs some good people around him to say, listen, man, what are you doing? What are you doing saying the things that you are saying right now? It's not a good look. I think the handling of this defeat has been an absolute PR disaster. And I just hope that he can get the good people around him and he can get some good help, because I would love to see him fight again, because we've spent some wonderful times with Deontay Wilder. He's been on our show on several occasions. He comes across as a top guy, tells some wonderful tales. And I want him to get back into that space. But right now, he seems a million miles away from it.
Yeah, I mean, Tyson Fury once said to me when he, in fact, to a group of us, when just before he was fighting Vladimir Klitschko 5 years ago, no one has the right to mooch around in my head. Yeah. And, you know, we're dealing, you know, we see these people day in, day out, Adam, you know, in the work we do. And, you know, fighters are very different people. It's a calling what they do. And I think they go through difficult times sometimes when mentally or emotionally they might have felt they've dealt with their loss, and then it comes back to haunt them emotionally when maybe they don't get the chance to put the record straight or to tell their story properly. And I do think a lot of things have got confused here. I mean, I've spoken to some of Wilder's back team, his support staff, this week. I mean, I can't quote them on record, but you know, I think what Deontay Wilder, I mean, I don't agree with a lot of these reasons he's been given. I know we're going to hear from Tyson from this interview I did with him. That's not come out in full yet. But I think he feels a bit let down that he's not getting the trilogy fight with Tyson Fury, because I was reminded by his people this week that when Tyson Fury wasn't feeling well mentally, Deontay Wilder did put messages out there saying to him, get well, come back and fight me, I'll give you the opportunity. And he did the second time as well. And I think he feels a bit hard done by, and I do think it's important, you know, I mean, I said myself, it felt like Jonte Wilder had taken a Halloween pill last weekend, you know, I mean, it was unbelievable some of the things he was coming out with, but he gave Tyson Fury the opportunity twice. We all feel that Tyson Fury won that, or many of us feel that Tyson won that first controversial draw, yep. But he did give Tyson an opportunity. And unfortunately, that ship is now sailing, and I think he's feeling it. Because we, as we've mentioned a million times on this show, and we will repeat again, we all want to see Tyson Fury against Anthony Joshua. Mm-hmm. So in a way, he's like the jilted lover of the heavyweight division, isn't he? He's the guy that no one wants at the moment. And I think that's what we've seen. I think, you know, and like you say, and it skewed him a little bit. The screw has got a little bit looser, as it does in all fighters at some points.
Which, listen, you can't excuse, well, you can't blame Tyson Fury for wanting to move on. It's his career. He wants to obviously crack on with it. And with the trilogy not happening, he wants to fight, and he wants to get cracking and push forward towards the Anthony Joshua fight. Personally, we've discussed this off air, didn't we? And I'm sure we can discuss this right now. I'm of the opinion that he doesn't necessarily need to fight Tyson Fury, but if he feels that he needs to fight in order for his own mental health or whatever it may be to get himself back into the rhythm of what he managed to accomplish by February of early this year, then cool, let's get in there. But I don't agree with a WBC heavyweight champion of the world, and in my opinion, the best heavyweight on the planet. I don't agree with a person of that stature having tick-over fights, having keep-busy fights. There's plenty of top talent out there, for me, that Tyson Fury could fight. I'm looking at Ajit Kabayel, and don't get me wrong, the lad's got a decent record. I'm looking at the guys that he's fought. They're all of European level at the very, very highest. This is massive step up for Ajit Kabayel, and I fully anticipate Tyson Fury. It's going to be one of those nights where maybe Tyson lowers his standard, because this is what sometimes he does when he fights someone that's well beneath him. The levels do sink a little bit because the motivation's not there. The jeopardy's not there for him as it would be for a Wilder or an Anthony Joshua type of fight. I personally would have liked to have seen him in with a better caliber.
Or like Oscar Rivas or a Hunter. Well, Rivas
Michael
is
Hunter.
Eight with...
Yeah, Hunter's Hunter, 10. Perfect.
Yeah, Hunter's 10 with as we, you know, you rightly pointed to that earlier on. You know, Michael Hunter at 10, you know, Oscar Rivas is 8 with the World Boxing Council.
That level, perfect. I look at Kabayel and I just think, I don't see what the point is for the best fighter on the planet to be fighting him. I really don't.
I completely understand. But, you know, I'll remind you and all our listeners that boxing is a sport, but professional boxing is also a business. And they're looking at those two huge fights next year, probably worth £300 or £400 million in total if both fights go ahead. You know, I mean, and that's the bottom line. You know, it's a keeping warm fight. It's a ticking over fight, whether we like it or not. And
If Anthony Joshua announces Ajit Kabayel, he would get so much abuse on social media, wouldn't he?
Yeah, he would. He would get abuse on social media. And you know, you know, Charles Martin is number 2 in the IBF at the moment, so he could end up fighting him again. By the way, you know, but there you go, and he could get a stick for that. So I mean, you know, the best fighting the best is what we want to see.
Of course.
And you make Adam, you're absolutely right in the point you're making. But unfortunately, boxing isn't run that way, you know. And that's why we get head over heels drunk in love with the great fights being made. Because, you know, in between times, there are some bum of the month fights. And that's what they were famously called. Joe Lewis used to fight the bum of the month, and that's what it was called.
So there you go. That's all the heavyweight chat. There's a lot of heavyweight guests coming your way in a minute. But first of all, the big story of the week, I suppose, was Canelo and his breakaway from DAZN and Golden Boy Promotions. Could this be now the caveat to other top names in the world of boxing doing the exact same thing, going promoterless and managing themselves? Here's the conversation. Canelo Alvarez is a free agent after parting ways with his broadcaster DAZN. And his promoter, Golden Boy Promotions. Eddie Reynoso, his manager, has claimed all this. And obviously, since that, The Zone have come out. They've made their statement. Golden Boy Promotions have made their statement of wished Canelo well in his future endeavours. And already they're talking about a fight for December the 19th against Caleb Plant, unifying the super middleweight division. Big news. Probably the biggest news that we've had over the last 7 days in the world of boxing. Because for those that don't know, The Zone splashed out an awful lot of money on signing exclusively Canelo Alvarez to their channel. He's had three fights with them. Rocky Fielding, Daniel Jacobs, and obviously stepping up to light heavyweight against Kovalev. Won them all, of course. And he's average, getting paid about $35 million a fight because the whole deal was worth $350 million. He was suing them for the best part of $280 million. I'm led to believe that all that has been washed away. He's walked away from the deal. They've walked away from the deal. And everybody's free to move forward.
Mm.
It is big, big news, Gareth. And I, for one, I'm kind of happy that this happened. And the reason that I'm happy for it is when you're a superstar to the size of someone like a Canelo, I don't think you need a promoter. And I don't think you need to be aligned to a particular television channel. What I think this now does, it frees Canelo up to set up his own promotion company, to manage himself, to do his own thing. And I hope that that's what he's going to do. I hope he doesn't align with somebody else. I hope he does his own thing. And if he wants to be earning the type of money that DAZN were throwing at him, the likes of the $30 and the $35 million a fight, then what he needs to do is obviously make the top fights. And if he, as the sole promoter and the sole person responsible for navigating his career now, can go make the top fights, I am sure that the broadcasters in America and around the world will throw money at him for fun. If he's fighting someone like a Billy Joe Saunders, do you think Sky aren't going to try and buy it, or ESPN aren't going to try and buy it? Mm. I think it's a wonderful, wonderful move for him. And it's a wonderful move for boxing because he is the main man. He is the biggest star in the sport. And hopefully now we get to see him taking on the very, very best in the divisions that he competes in.
Yeah, and there'll be no delays to the fights. You know, for those wanting the conversion, it's £278 million, that deal with DAZN. Look, he's going to fight on DAZN. He's going to fight on, like you say, wherever he wants to fight. I mean, the strains of that Mexican song, the joy and the delight in it, was the man singing that he's a free agent because he knows he'll earn 60, 70 million a fight now. It's a weird thing to say, but even though he's not a heavyweight, he is the biggest star in boxing.
No doubt.
The most watched boxer. 30 million Mexicans watch him every time he fights. He's an extraordinary star, and it's been one of the worst kept secrets in boxing for well over a couple of years that there has been a terrible schism between Golden Boy Promotions and the Reynosos, who have coached young Canelo. I mean, he's not young Canelo anymore, is he? But redhead Canelo for a very long time, and you know they manage him as well. And I think there's been that struggle, and I think the COVID situation and DAZN not wanting to pay, you know, $35 million a fight because they can't get an audit, they can't get a huge gate. Every fight he has is a sellout. They wanted the Golovkin fight as soon as possible, I understand. And I think we may now see him still have a DAZN fight with Golovkin. Or you never know, it could be done with Eddie Hearn. I wonder whether Eddie Hearn will step in now and do a deal with the Canelo company, if you like. But it you know, it's gone very sour because when you think that DAZN in America built their platform on Eddie Hearn America, or sorry, Matchroom USA, or Eddie Hearn America, it's the same thing, and Golden Boy in America, that was their platform to begin with, and Golden Boy in boxing, of course. You know, there's multiple other sports, but that was their route in to creating a great schedule for the year, for each year. It's not there anymore now. So where it leaves Golden Boy and DAZN is a very interesting question as well. And where it leaves Golden Boy, because Canelo wasn't just the linchpin. He almost was their stable. Ryan Garcia is still there, of course. Mm. We haven't mentioned him tonight.
They got Virgil Ortiz and Ryan Garcia, but yeah, they're not superstars to the extent of Canelo.
No, Ryan Garcia is still an Instagram superstar.
Yeah.
He's got to beat Luke Campbell first in a fascinating fight that's coming up on, was it December the 12th, is it?
5th.
December the 5th on the Tyson Fury night with us. I think we're going to be with Tyson Fury, actually, hopefully that night in the UK.
Yep.
So, you know, we'll be watching that later on in the evening. You know, Canelo is an extraordinary star again. I mean, I'm going to wax lyrical now about this guy. He's so modest. He's so humble. He lives for the sport. He rides his horses under the stars and goes cooking out in the wild, he told me, with his friends between fights.
I just want to say at this point, that for people listening to this, this is first-hand experience because we've been
adding horses together.
Well, you've been one of the guys that has actually got off their backside and flown around the world, like over to Mexico, over to his camps in California, and spent proper time with him. I know that, obviously, you speak the language, so therefore the conversations that you have with him, you've built up a nice little relationship there over a period of time of covering his fight. So I just wanted people who were listening to this to understand that you're not just guessing at what this guy's like. You've been in these camps and you've spent time with him.
No, he's very humorous as well. I mean, the last time I saw him was in a camp in San Diego. Flew in specially to a photo shoot with a lady I'm doing a book with, Sonia Jasinski, brilliant photographer. And we're doing a big, big book on the main boxers, promoters and protagonists in the sport in this epoch. And they were brilliant to have us into that camp. And he... You know, he's just an extraordinary character, Adam. You know, I mean, I go back to the days of him fighting Floyd Mayweather. I mean, yeah. This is a guy who only lost to Floyd Mayweather, you know?
And he was very young at that point. Very was he 21, young. 22 years of age when that happened?
Exactly. You know, and he's the sixth or the seventh of six or seven boxing brothers.
Yeah.
They've appeared on the same card in Jalisco, Guadalajara, Mexico, together. I'm only rolling my R's, so
yes,
stop it.
And I'm
Jote Majotas.
Just on this, on what he's got, what he's about to do now, and I envisage him doing Canelo Promotions and doing his own thing, very similar to what Floyd did when Floyd broke away from his promotional deals and what have you and managed himself. Can you see other top names doing something similar to this, not having a promoter, managing themselves, the likes of Tyson Fury, the likes of Anthony Joshua, the biggest names, the guys that are earning the multi-millions? Can you see that happening?
Definitely. And Devin Haney, he's already a promoter, Devin Haney, remember? He made himself a promoter at the age of 19. You know, he couldn't get a license at the age of 16. So him and his dad head down to Mexico, cross the border and fight men for 4 years in the back kind of bars of, in the back rooms of taverns. And you've got these kind of 30-year-old Mexican men trying to knock his head off, and not one of them can take him apart. He decides to come back to America age 19 and makes himself a promoter. He's got a promoter's license. That's the way to go. That's the way they've seen it. You know, that's what Floyd Mayweather did for so many. Amir Khan had his own promotional company.
Yeah.
Carl Froch did in the end. Manny Pacquiao's got it. When you get big enough, when you know enough people will watch you where you can take the cut you deserve, because you're the gladiator, you're the one fighting for freedom and legacy for your family for generations and generations, go do it. It's a business transaction at the end of the day, and your life's on the line when you fight.
There you go, a conversation about the current Ring Magazine pound-for-pound number one fighter in the world. Nice how I've done that. The segue into this next section, seamless. That's what we do here on Fight Night, because the first Scotsman has been inducted into that top 10 pound-for-pound list this week. Josh Taylor hit number 9 spot. I'd just like to point out that the Ring Magazine pound-for-pound list only started in 1989. But he's the first Scot to feature on that list, and he joined us on the show to talk about it. Pound-for-pound, top 10. How does that feel?
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, seeing my name in amongst these fighters and now being mentioned, you know, with the recognition that I think I deserve. I've been deserving of the Wrist Kingdom recognition for a while, I think. You know, so it's good to finally getting the recognition from people now and finally getting recognised as a real top fighter, you know, and getting the kind of recognition that I believe I deserve. So, yeah, it's real nice. And, you know, when I saw the rankings the other day, it was good to see my name in there, you know, and a little sense of a feeling of pride, you know, and a wee sense of achievement, and especially being the first Scotsman involved in it as well, you know. So, yeah, it's another little piece of history to be made. And, yeah, I'm very happy with myself, very pleased.
There's only one place in that top 10 that we can go now, my man, when we start to unify and become undisputed champions of that super lightweight division.
Yeah, that's it. The only way is up, baby. The only way is up. and to be honest, though, like, you know, I've always said that, you know, all that, like, sort of the pound-for-pound rankings and this and that, it really doesn't bother me at all, really, you know, but it is nice hearing, you know, getting the recognition that I think I deserve, you know, mm-hmm. especially given my last, you know, 4 or 5 fights, you know, being very the world-class operators, you know, at the top of the game, and I've only had 17 fights. I'm very well decorated, you know, and so I do believe that, you know, it is nice finally getting the recognition that I deserve. I never lost any sleep over it before, you know, so it is nice.
Yeah, sorry, Josh, didn't mean to interrupt you, but one of the things that people must know out there is that in your last 5 fights, this is one of the reasons why you're in that top pound-for-pound list, you're ahead of Gennady Golovkin right now. I mean, that is huge. Your last 5 opponents before you fought them, their records collectively were 110 victories and 1 loss. Mm. So it's those kind of details. You know, I work for the Ring magazine as well. It's those kind of details that we look at when you put those kind of things across. It's because of the excellence that you've shown. But you need to get better and bigger now, because you're representing your country. Ken Buchanan would have been in that list all those years ago if the pound-for-pound rankings of the Ring existed then. But you are the greatest Scottish boxer since that guy Ken Buchanan, who fought the very best in the same kind of, in the same area, the same, kind of similar divisions at lightweight and around there. So, it, you know, we know... I mean, I've spoken to Ben about this, Ben Davison, who trained Tyson Fury. Ben said to me after you knocked out Appensung in a round with a body shot that the world is this guy's... Sorry, the sky is this guy's limit. Literally, you could go to the top of the pound-for-pound list. Do you know that you have that capability inside yourself?
Yeah, 100%. I've always said to myself that I believe I can go to the very top of the game, you know. I'm not one for shouting my mouth off and saying, I'm going to do this and I'm going to do that and I'm this and I'm that. I really actually like the way that I've come up and stamped my name on the world scene. I've done it kind of under the radar and come up and sort of shocked everyone. And I like it like that, you know. It's I've not put any pressure on myself. I've just been quietly confident and, you know, and believed in myself all these years, you know. So now people are finally sort of coming around to saying, oh, this guy can really fight, you know, he's a good fighter, and getting the recognition I deserve given my last 5 performances. I honestly do believe that anybody goes in the ring in the opposite corner from me, I believe I'm beating them. You know, I could be in there with a heavyweight and he's in standing opposite corner, and I believe I'm going to win that fight. You know, it's doesn't matter who's in front of me, I believe my ability, and I believe my own ability, and my heart, my grit, determination. You know, there's absolutely no quitting there. You know, I'd rather die in there than I'd rather go out with my shield. You know, that's the kind of fighter I am. I'll leave it all in the ring, and I really do. I believe I can beat anybody when I'm on my A game, and especially boxing wise. When I decide to box and move, I don't believe there's anybody that can outbox me and outsmart me when I decide to play like that. You know, it's I tend to fight these fights on my terms, you know. I tend to go, right, that's it, I've had enough of boxing, I'm having a fight now. And then I start pushing the fight and I get thrown into a bit more of a fight than I should have. But, you know, it makes for exciting fights, but it's just the way I am. But, you know, I really do believe when I box, there's hardly anybody that can beat me.
That's why you're selling thousands of tickets up in Scotland, my friend, and no doubt now around the world. Now, this kind of leads us, that attitude and the way, all the things that you've achieved so far, kind of leads us now to be on the cusp of something really, really special. We know that Jack Catterall, the WBO mandatory in this division, is going to step aside from his fight with Jose Ramirez, which kind of clears the path for you and Jose to get together, to bring this division together. Where are we at with those conversations? How far down the line are we? And do we have a target date in mind of when that will happen?
We've not got a target date or anything yet. You know, I'm still to hear from my management team, MTK, just to see kind of what's happening. You know, I've kind of left it for the last couple of weeks. But they did say, you know, they're in talks and they're saying it's looking for sort of the early part of next year. So excellent. I'm already back in the gym. I'm already back training, and you know, just in case, you know, I'm already back training on that anyway. So we're sort of expecting next year, early part of this year. So next year, sorry. And you know, yeah. So just to take this opportunity as well to say also a thank you to Jack Carroll for, you know, agreeing to step aside and let this fight happen. You know, it's that was really good of him, because I know if I was in that position, that would have been really hard for me to swallow and say no. You know, being a fighter and obviously wanting to do my own thing, I would have wanted that fight. So I just want to say, take this opportunity to thank Jack for that as well.
Yeah, he was on the show and he intimated that a few weeks ago now. And like you say, very generous spirited of him. I'm on the Josh Taylor hype train at the moment, and I'm not going to make any bones about this, Josh. Yeah, Jose Ramirez, I think is a very close fight. I mean, but I believe in you. I mean, you know, I've come and visited you. You're the only, I think you're the only boxer out of the bubble that I've been to visit before you fought Konsong. You know, and it was great to see you, and I think there's a big change in you. Do you think, even though Kell Brook is challenging Terence Crawford next weekend in Las Vegas, and Adam and I are doing tons on that next week heading into the show, we've had interviews with all of them, it's going to be spectacular, and Kell could pull off a victory if he produces his best performance ever, and I mean ever, for every second of every minute of every round, but I would love if you beat Jose Ramirez to go and find Terence Crawford and challenge him, because I think you and him is a massive fight, and that is your route to the top of the pound for pound list, in my view. Would you take a fight with him?
Yeah, I'd take a fight with Crawford tomorrow. You know, I believe that I could beat him as well. I believe I can beat him as well. I don't think he's unbeatable.
What about Kell against him next week?
I think Kell is, everybody's writing him off. I don't think anybody should write him off. You know, Kell is a very good fighter. He's massive for welterweight, and he's a serious puncher as well. You know, people give him stick for the two fights that he's lost, but look at the two people that he lost against. You know, two absolute monsters. You know,
on the pound for pound list, they're there, mate.
Yeah,
Errol Spence,
you know,
and Gennady.
Absolute monsters. You know, and took some serious damage in their fights as well, and still did really well. You know, so I'm not writing Kell off. You know, I think he can pull it off. I think it'll be a Crawford points win. But I do think Kell gives him a run for his money, and definitely at times gives him a hard time.
There might be an undisputed champion coming to your division soon, a Teofimo Lopez that obviously beat Vasyl Lomachenko a couple of weeks ago. What did you make of that performance, Josh?
Yeah, I thought it was very good. You know, it definitely, you know, I was expecting Loma to come through that fight on points. You know, just that I was expecting him to sort of just outbox him and manoeuvre him and outsmart him. But ultimately, I think it was what was the key factor to Lopez's win, I think, was the size difference. Ultimately, the size difference and the weight difference as well. Mm. In the end, you know, Lopez looked massive compared to Lomachenko on the night. You know, but having said that, he was very smart with his tactics. He come out, you know, and he beat Lomachenko with a jab, and you know, and he wasn't rushing Lomachenko. He was being very patient, so he was very nice and patient, calm and collected. And I just thought, you know, he did very well. So yeah, hats off, he did very well.
You'd welcome him to super lightweight, wouldn't you?
Yeah, of course. You know, if anybody wants to fight me, I'll fight. I'm more than happy to fight absolutely anybody. So I'm not shying away from anyone or anybody, any fight, anywhere, any place. I'll fight everybody. I'm not scared to fight anyone, you know. So whoever wants to fight, as long as everything's right, I'll fight them.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to one full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
There you go, Josh Taylor speaking to us about the possibility of his upcoming fight with Jose Ramirez. Fingers crossed we can get that signed off real soon and unify that super lightweight division. The UK got themselves a new world champion last weekend. Savannah Marshall picked up the WBO Middleweight Championship of the World. She joined us on the show at the weekend and she's chasing down Clarissa Shields. We had to wait for it because obviously everything that's going on in the pandemic with COVID tests and various things like that, the fight was pushed back with what have you. But when you put in a performance like last weekend, Savannah, which I've no doubt you worked hours in the gym, hours and hours are in the gym, and when it plays out in front of your eyes, punch perfect on the night, how satisfying is that?
Oh, honestly, I couldn't, like you just said there, for months and months, I was fights were getting cancelled, they were getting pushed back, and then 2 weeks prior to that, Peter, my coach, tested positive for COVID. So then it was, for me, I was thinking, God, am I even going to fight this year? And then for me, it just felt like everything just worked out for the better. All the puzzle pieces fitted. You know, it was the platform, the show. It was just crazy how everything worked out after so much heartbreak, really.
Now, listen, this is no disrespect to anybody else on the card, but it was without doubt the performance of the night, so congratulations on that. And I know that once the fight was over, the question started then, didn't they? The microphone went straight in the face, and obviously Clarissa Shields' name is mentioned on you. And I love the way that you dealt with it. You were straight on. Said, listen, if she wants to tango, let's tango. However, we have heard this week that she's going to be fighting, I think, the first week of December. She's teaming up with Dana White, the UFC president, because he's starting to get into the world of boxing. It's looking like Clarissa Shields is being lined up for some type of super fight with the UFC star Amanda Nunes, and they're pushing her towards maybe MMA and boxing. Is she running away from you, Savannah? What's going on, man? This is the fight that we want to see. Where's she going?
Exactly, I told you in the interview, she doesn't want none of me. Yes, I knew about that, so. But look, you know, she makes her own choices, but I'm confident that fight will be around for a while, because in boxing, you know, there's nowhere else for her to go, so she's got to go to that UFC, down that UFC route. But I'm even more confident that the fight between me and Clarissa will come off in 2021.
Speaking of WBO world titles, there's a vacant one in the cruiserweight division. Lauren Sokoli is a man that will be fighting for it against Christoph Glowacki. The story of Sokoli is absolutely unbelievable. He joined us on the show at the weekend to talk about it. who would have thought, and I put this out on social media a couple of weeks ago, once this all was finalised, this fight with Christoph Glowacki, who would have thought the conversations that we've had over the years with your with your journey in boxing, from starting after watching the Olympics, obviously everybody knows where you were at, working at the burger joint, flipping the burgers, to getting ourselves to this situation now where you're challenging for a world title. It is stuff of dreams, mate. It's a Rocky Balboa film.
You know, that obviously I feel blessed. One of my friends actually went past the old burger place that I was working at and sent me a picture of it today. And it really hit home. You know, obviously, as you live life, you kind of just kind of progress and kind of sometimes forget. But, you know, that really brought it back to me. And, yeah, I think it's amazing to kind of see the journey that I'm on right now.
And speaking of journeys, I think we're all extremely excited about you teaming up with Shane and the improvements that you've had to the game. Has it been, I know this is going to sound weird, but has the pandemic been kind of a blessing that you can go into the shadows a little bit and work at all the things that you need to work on in order to get the job done on the 12th of December?
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, it's definitely given me a lot more time to work and, you know, connect with my coach, build a lot more trust. You know, there's already trust there, but even more, just, you know, I think the main thing that's really helped me with is, you know, coming to terms with the fact that I have a world title shot and it's a big fight, as opposed to it just being, oh, listen, you're going into it in, you know, a couple of months. It's been like a, you know, a year of, you know what, instead of it being exciting and, you know, a big occasion, it's now, it's like, you know, it's a formality, go in there, do what you need to do. So I feel good.
Good evening, Lawrence, how are you? It's Gareth.
Oh, hi Gareth, I feel good.
Good. This is a really big step up for you. I've been watching Christoph Glowacki, and I think there's positives for you in this fight, because he's quite easy to hit with the right hand, I think you'll agree, but there's other things about him that he's vastly experienced compared to you. But
yeah.
But you know, we've spoken for a long time about this, but you have a very, and I've always backed it, everyone talks about your awkward style. I think your awkward style is a very good matchup for this guy. Do you not feel that you can tie him up a lot as well?
I do. You know, when I watch his fights, I can see he's a good fighter. Like, it's clear. Do you know what I'm saying? I could see that he's a good fighter, but I just say to myself, you know what? Stylistically, you know, my height, reach, strength on the inside, I think are all going to come into play. And I'm hoping, obviously, as you do, you know, for it to be quite a dominant one-sided performance on my part. But, you know, I'm prepared for anything. But I really do see my sort of skill set kind of just nullifying and overwhelming his.
Did you... Sorry, I thought you were going to go on there. Do you get Adam's point that maybe lockdown has been a good thing for you? Because you've always said to me, I'm always going to be ready. That's the way I am as a person. That's the way I've been. It's my mantra since I stepped between the ropes. Or since I stepped away from the burger joint, as Adam mentioned.
Yeah.
And, you know, you're going to take the most of every opportunity, and that you are ready for this. And at the beginning of lockdown, you might not have expected it, but it's here now.
Yeah. No, I feel exactly what you're saying. Do you know what I mean? Like, for me, as I said, the lockdown, it's allowed me to really come to terms with everything, really work on certain techniques. And I think more so mindset, you know, a lot of people have the physical attributes to win fights or, you know, be in big fights, but they haven't got the mental to win. You know, you can put an identical person to myself in the ring, but if they think differently or their mentality is different, there's going to be a different outcome. So I think it's a major part is, you know, my mindset, and the time must help me to even improve on that.
What have the kids been like in the local area to where you live, mate? Because you were inspired by the Olympics in 2012 and what AJ was doing, and that's kind of come full circle now. You know, people are watching you. The youths are going to be watching you and thinking, man, this guy was doing this 8 years ago, and now look at him. You know, that's an incredibly powerful story.
Yeah, and you know what? Once this fight was announced, I think it really hit me. You know, obviously I have my own, you know, agendas for winning stuff and, you know, my own sort of, you know, mindset. But, you know, once the fight was announced, it really hit home, you know, with the amount of messages that I got of, you know, not just congrats, but like, of mate, your story is so inspirational to me. Even, you know, school teachers as well as school kids, you know, and it's like, because obviously I've been quite open with, you know, certain stuff that I went through growing up and stuff, I think it makes it a little bit relatable to certain people. And, you know, that just urges me on with training and dieting and everything, because, you know, I realise it's bigger than just me, you know. Any bit of success that I'm able to get, you know, if it's able to motivate future kids, future stars, like, I'm waiting for my, you know, guys, you know what? I used to watch Girls of Coley and then that helped me.
It's happening, man. It might happen on the 12th, you know?
Hopefully, that's all I can do is hope. And, you know, if there is a kid out there, I'm ready to support you. Just come through and tell me. Do you know what I'm saying? But yeah, good.
A man responsible for making that fight is, of course, Eddie Hearn, Matchroom Boxing Supremo. Gareth A. Davies caught up with him earlier on last week to just touch upon everything in the world of boxing. They started by talking Usyk Chisora.
Dillian White, Alexander Povetkin's off. What's going to happen with that?
We're going to move that to January the 30th, and then we're going to keep our Saturday 21st of November show as a Saturday night fight night, which fans will be happy about. Conor Benn will headline in a great fight there, and a lot of heavyweight fights.
Yeah.
Against Formella.
Formella,
the distance with Sean Porter. It's a big step up for him, and a lot of big heavyweight fights as well. I've got to be honest with you, Gareth. It's drama, drama, drama. You know, we're up against it in every sense of the word. But we're enjoying the challenge. You know, this is a challenge that we will hopefully never experience again. And there's two ways to look at it. You either sulk and moan and shut the doors, or you know, open your shirt, you beat on your chest, and you say, let's go. You know, and that's a no context hand classic for the founder there. But it's true, you know, you have to try and keep the momentum in the sport. I think actually our schedule, you know, starting from Usyk Chisora to the end of the year, is one of the strongest schedules we've ever finished with. We have no crowd. You know, you're talking about probably 40% of the revenue of a show gone, wiped away.
What do you, in retrospect, after seeing Alexander Usyk's performance against Derek Chisora, what was your take on his first legitimate heavyweight performance?
I think he's always going to be undersized as a heavyweight. You're right, styles make fights. Against a more technical fighter, he's probably going to be more effective. Against a rugged, durable brawler like Chisora, you know, it's going to take him a little bit of time to sort of get over that and adapt. What Usyk does so well is he was under fire for three rounds, wasn't he? Just adapted. He didn't start.
He was under pressure.
But what he did was, you know, he went from boxing off the back foot to actually controlling the middle of the ring and saying, I can't keep doing this because I'm getting walked down. I'm getting beaten up at times. So I need to stand my ground. He hurt Chisora badly in the seventh round. I don't think the big heavyweights will necessarily look at Usyk and say, oh, this guy's a danger. But what he's going to be very difficult to beat, because the only way Usyk's going to get beaten is when it's almost not on a level playing field. I mean, it is, because once you reach that weight at heavyweight, you know, it's all in, isn't it? But the only way he's going to get beaten, he couldn't get beaten at cruiserweight. No one's going to beat him at cruiserweight. But as he fights the bigger man, you know, who has the sharp combinations, you know, the power, the speed, the movement himself, then it's going to get very difficult for him. But what Chisora did well, you can let these fighters like Lomachenko and like Usyk dictate the pace and just keep you thinking, and they drain you. Tony Bell, you said it. You know, see, after six rounds, I was exhausted because I was looking at his feet. You know, he was using his right hand to sort of take me off my rhythm. Chisora showed no respect for that.
Yeah.
And as a heavyweight, what you can't do if you're AJ and go in there and start boxing and fencing with Usyk, you have to show him no respect. You have to walk him down, you have to back him up, and you have to try and beat him up. The one disadvantage Usyk has is he doesn't carry the heavyweight artillery of, you know, Deontay Wilder, Anthony Joshua, you know, these big hitting
all
heavyweights.
All Tyson Fury comes to that.
True.
He's a 19
yeah, true,
stone man.
True.
You know, he knocked Wilder about, didn't he?
Yeah, so, for sure. So, you know, that's, but what he has got is bundles of skill, great movement, tremendous feet, and he's a danger. You know, I think Alexander Usyk's going to give every heavyweight in the world a tough, tough fight. So, you know, be interesting to see how that plays out in 2021.
You mentioned just now to me before I started recording with the audio that Conor Benn's going to headline the White Povetkin card now. Joshua and Pulev, have you you know, is the decision made on how it goes ahead, where it goes ahead? You're going to carry on at Wembley Arena, I understand. You're not going to go to the O2.
We haven't completely decided yet, but you know, the thought behind going to the O2 was to try and get 4,000 or 5,000 people in there. Obviously, that was pre-lockdown. We'll still keep pushing for that, but it does start to look unlikely. If we can't get a crowd, you know, we've taken over Wembley Arena for 6 weeks. It would make sense to place that fight in there. We're fully built and we've got a great system in place. But, you know, literally it's event by event by event at the moment. You know, we are, Alexander Povetkin got COVID, you know. Then on the same day, someone else got cut. Then that next morning, someone else got injured. And then you replace the fight. So literally at the moment, you know, you are just, anything can happen. So I'll probably finish this interview, go in the office, there'll be another fight falling through. You make another one. You know, he goes for his COVID test on Friday, fails his test. You know, we've got a show in Florida this week with Devin Haney against Urokis Gamboa. They all tested yesterday, the entire card, negative. You know, it is just, you know, boxing gives you the greatest highs, but it also can kick you in the proverbials at any time. Normally, there is a 5% chance that on fight week, you may lose a fight. Mm. Now, there's a 50% chance, you know? So actually, you just have to keep smiling and laughing, because the other day when we had three fights fall through, in the end, I just started laughing to myself. And I said, if you don't laugh, you'll cry. So, you know, just solve the short-term problems, keep going, but we must keep the momentum of the sport going.
One of your golden peacocks in America, you mentioned there, Devin Haney, fantastic fighter in a really sexy lightweight division now, where you could pick eight people and have an eight-man tournament that would be better than anything in the world, almost. It's virtually the strongest weight class, I think, now. Obviously, Urokis Gamboa, very experienced. He lost Terence Crawford and Gervonta Davis last time out. Is this an opportunity on Saturday for Devin to show his wares, you know, when there's going to be a big audience watching this?
For sure. I think that people just presume that Devin Haney is the next Floyd Mayweather, but he's never boxed anyone at the levels of Urokis Gamboa. And actually, last time out, although he damaged his shoulder, he didn't look great. So, you know, for people to say after Tank Gervonta Davis struggling with Gamboa, really, let's be honest. I mean, Gamboa ruptured his Achilles in the second round. He went 12 rounds to the 12th round with Tank and had a lot of success. I think this is a massive test for Devin Haney, you know, and it's a bigger test because I know Devin Haney. He will want to set the world alight on Saturday. Do you know what I mean? He won't just want to go out there and, you know, get the victory. He wants to make a statement. He wants you and the fans to say, Haney can beat Lopez, Haney can beat Tank, because they're the mega fights in 2021.
Next weekend, the weekend after this, you've got, I think this is again, you're breaking new ground. You've got Ebony Bridges coming over from Australia, Rachel Ball, you've got Miriam Gutierrez challenging Katie Taylor.
Terry Harper.
I mean, does it please you to be able to put something historic on as well during this time? I don't think I can ever remember. I don't think there's ever been three women's world titles.
No, I don't think there's been two. I mean, there probably has been two, but not very frequently. But this is just shows you where women's boxing, still got a long way to go. And I've seen a couple of articles lately about, you know, oh, some of the women aren't getting paid as much as the men. It has nothing to do with that. Each fight is based upon the commercial value of each fight. And right now, some women's world title fights have the same commercial value as a good men's British world title fight. Do you know what I mean? So you've got the stars that are earning considerable purses. Katie Taylor, Clarissa Shields, Brackhouse, you know, even Terry Harper going to those kind of levels now. But there's still a long way to go. Next week will show us where we're at.
There you go. That's all the modern day boxing taken care of. I think it's fair that we finished this week's podcast with a trip down memory lane. All the way back, 1987. April is the month I'm taking you to. Caesar's Palace, the location for Hagler versus Leonard. The super fight. The first fight that generated over $100 million in revenue. Brian Dugan, award-winning writer, has written a book on that. It's out now. You can get it. I'll give you all the details in a moment or so. But he joined me on the show at the weekend to talk about the book. Of all the fights that you have covered in your illustrious career, why have you chosen this particular fight to write a book about?
That's a great question. And to be honest, I'm quite surprised in a way that it hasn't been done to this extent before. There was a book written by a guy, Steve Marantz, former Boston Globe writer, and he did get into the kind of story. But But I felt there was a bit more to tell in terms of the fighters' backgrounds, as you alluded to, Adam. It's just fascinating, the two guys, and what you spoke about there in terms of the careers of four men, of whom these were two integral parts, Sugar Ray Leonard and Marvellous Marvin Hagler. You also had Thomas the Hitman Hearns. You had the Hands of Stone, Roberto Duran. Between the four of them, they engaged in nine absolutely compelling fights throughout the whole of the decade. But the centrepiece fight for me was Hagler-Leonard, because Marvin Hagler had beaten Tommy Hearns and Roberto Duran, and Sugar Ray Leonard had done the same. And there almost had to be that box-off between the pair of them. But, of course, circumstances meant that when they might have thought earlier in the decade, it didn't happen. And it was late in the decade, perhaps when both men were actually past their prime, their absolute peak, when they actually did collide. But it was still a stunning encounter that captured the imagination of the world. It was the first $100 million super fight. Mm. And to this day, it spawns debates and controversy among boxing fans of a certain vintage who would recall the fight quite easily.
You just mentioned, obviously, the Four Kings there. And for our younger listeners, and I don't want to do anybody a disservice because I'm sure that they are well-versed on the world of boxing, but just talk to me about, between those four kings, the weight disparities, because we had a king at lightweight, really, didn't we? And then we had, obviously, the welterweight king, and we had guys competing at middleweight, and they all managed, in some way, shape or form, to meet each other and come to some type of compromises on those weight disparities to get the big fights on for the fans.
Absolutely. Marvin Hagler was the one who never changed weight class. Barry Tompkins, the former HBO commentator, now works with Showtime, he used to say that he used to describe him as a man born at middleweight. And and it kind of fitted Hagler very well. But you're right. I mean, Roberto Duran, you know, I mean, Leonard and Hagler are the two most fascinating individuals for me. Roberto Duran, however, I mean, in terms of true boxing fans, and indeed among the boxers themselves, he's the ultimate fighter's fighter. He was just this raw kid from a slum in Panama City, and he had ruled the lightweights for a decade. He beat Ken Buchanan almost at the beginning of the 1970s, and it was 1980 before he actually got into the ring with Ray Leonard at welterweight. Mm. So, of course, as you say, they actually all climbed, and Leonard was a welterweight throughout his career. He jumped up to light middleweight. Never went as far as middleweight until he actually made this grand comeback, which people thought he was out of his mind for even attempting, because he had been 5 years out of the ring when he came back to fight Hagler, with just one fight, in which he was very unimpressive against Kevin Howard. And you had Thomas Hearns as well, who was, you know, he was an almost freakish welterweight, 6'1.5", and arms like pistons, and a devastating punch at welterweight. And, of course, as you know well, Adam, he was able to rise through the divisions and ultimately fight at light heavyweight, even at cruiserweight. Mm. But they did all collide in the middle division. Even, as you say, Duran, who was the smallest of the four. Mm-hmm. But he just had that just raw aggression in him, but also fantastic technique. And they just brought... not only, they brought glamour and glitz, but they brought true grit as well, and that's what made them so compelling in their art at that time.
Out of Hagler and Leonard, whose story are you more fascinated with?
It's really interesting. That's why I thought it was worth doing, because it's only in recent years that we've really got to know Ray beyond the veneer of the all-American kid, the hero, the man who was the golden boy. Hagler would suggest he was born with a silver spoon in his mouth. Compared to Hagler's upbringing, he was. Mm. But that's not true, you know, in terms of Ray Leonard was from a very working-class background as well. But you know, he had this kind of aura around him, and it was almost too good to be true, and it was. Mm. I mean... Ray brought out his memoir about 7-8 years ago, very candid, spoke about his alcoholism, spoke about his abuse of cocaine, and spoke about sexual abuse, which no one had known about until that moment. So it was actually, there was a much deeper character there that was well worth exploring anew, I felt. But in terms of the two, in terms of their background, I honestly think that Marvin Hagler growing up in Central Ward, Newark, New Jersey, at the time of race riots in the late 1960s in America, quite reminiscent of what the country has been going through very recently too. But at that time, he grew up in Central Ward, which was notorious. And there were 27 people killed during a five-day period in which the city was just a crucible. And race was at the root of the problem in the city. And over 1,000 people injured. For 3 days, he and his family were trapped in their apartment building, and their mother, his mother, Ida May, told all of the kids that for the duration of the 3 days, they would remain on the floor. And there was very good reason, because if you went to the window, you stood a chance of being shot by a National Guardsman or a policeman, as some of the victims were. And so I just felt in terms of Marvin, who was this loner, whose solitude, you know, he had this kind of prison environment that he secluded himself in Provincetown when he became this great champion. But he was a loner all his life. And it emanates from this really hard, tough upbringing in a city that became just a crucible at that time of racial unrest. And I felt that was really worth exploring, because The Four Kings have been written about. George Kimball wrote an excellent book, but he hadn't explored to the same depth that hopefully I have been able to go into that background of Hagler's, which I think is integral to knowing why he became the great champion he was.
It's the characters that you've managed to explore in the Superfight book, and I encourage anybody listening to this to most certainly get their hands on it, especially if you're a big fan of the greats, because you're right in what you've said there. The thing that I love about covering this sport, of course, the fight nights are great, and you go there and we're all here for watching the athletes perform at their very, very best, but it's the characters for me. It's the stories. It's the places that they've come from. Hagler's story is absolutely captivating, as you've caught in this book, but the thing that took my breath away from knowing a little bit about the memoirs of Ray Leonard and what you've put in this particular piece. Growing up as a kid, my dad was a big fan of Ray Leonard. So therefore, all the stories were always positive and shiny. Like you've said, the All-American kid, the Olympian, that's the only thing I kind of knew about him. And obviously, I've watched the fights and what have you. But then hearing about this darker side, the troubles that he's had, the alcoholism, the cocaine abuse, and obviously the sexual abuse that he suffered at the hands of a coach and what have you, that kind of fleshes out the character even more. It makes my respect for him even more, because it makes him more human. I don't know if you feel like that, because I had him on a pedestal, you know what I mean? And he became more human when I knew more things about him.
I agree with you completely, Adam. And that's actually, you know, why I felt it was worth visiting in this kind of depth, to kind of tell the story of both men again, as well as tell the story of the fight, because I agree with you completely. You know, while we are drawn to the ringside because of just the heroic nature of what these guys are able to do, very often it's the stories about the guys, it's their backgrounds that is utterly compelling, and I think that's why you establish particular allegiance with one guy or another. You know, Marvin Hagler was the quintessential working class blue collar champion. He really was. I mean, he was just the poster boy for that. Ray, you're absolutely right. He had this image, and of course, you know, we've seen it probably throughout history in terms of Olympians. They kind of have this image attached to them, and Ray cultivated that. He was very good at using that, and of course, which became central to how he trapped Hagler in the end. In terms of financially, it was very good for him, and he tapped into that greatly. But as you say, there was something deeper to him, and I always felt that. And one of my former colleagues, Hugh Michael Vanney, on the Sunday Times,
great, right? Yeah.
And the Observer as well, and he spoke about this hard chip of ice that was buried deep in Ray's fighting heart. You know, a terrible darkness he described that he must have endured to fuel, you know, some of these performances. Because, you know, Ray Leonard was this flashy type guy. He was the guy who would, you know, throw the bolo punches and all of that. But when you got right down to it, for instance, when he fought Tommy Hearns, you know, the famous hitman and the hitman persona, and he absolutely blasted guys out of there. But when you got down to the nitty gritty, the real hard man in the ring, when it was Tommy Hearns and Ray Leonard, was Ray Leonard. You know, he was an absolutely mean monster himself. But he was driven by these demons. And I always felt, in terms of the ninth round, you know, we can talk about the fight a little bit, I guess. But you know, the early rounds, Hagler kind of almost gave away. By the middle rounds, he's coming into it, coming on strong. In the ninth round, Leonard gets trapped in his own corner. And people at ringside felt that this was the moment. Hagler was now going to just bludgeon his man away, as he had every man he had faced for 11 years. He was unbeaten for the previous 11 years. Mm. And undaunted during much of that time. He had destroyed people like Tommy Hearns, Alan Minter, as we know. But in the ninth round, he has Leonard trapped in the corner. And rather than cave in, as was almost expected when you saw this unfold, Leonard somehow managed to fight his way out of the corner twice, throwing, you know, just searing bursts of punches. And I always wanted to know, like, what could drive a man to do that when you're in [S2] Mm. [S1] When you're in that moment, when you're trapped against this dominant, fearsome character. I mean, he destroyed people. I mean, his fight [S2] Yeah. [S1] Against Tommy Hearns just drew the breath away. But somehow Leonard had just that fortitude within him, and it was interesting to explore then why he might have that in him.
There you go, little stocking filler for Christmas for you. If you're a big boxing fan, or you know a big boxing fan, get them that book. You will not go far wrong. Thank you very much for listening to the podcast. Hopefully you've enjoyed it. There'll be loads of stuff coming up next week as we build up towards Crawford versus Brook. Can Kell Brook become a two-time welterweight world champion? You'll hear from him, Crawford, and Bob Arum on next week's podcast or next week's show if you join us live. So make sure you do that on Saturday night on TalkSport. But failing it, make sure you subscribe to the podcast. iTunes is the destination, or via TalkSport.com. We'll catch you next time.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.